evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Cote in Washington, D.C.
I think that the main challenge is to leverage the participation of the citizens. If you see the campaign, it has been really very calm. It can be linked to the Ramadan, the fasting period, both for Christians and for Muslims.
Senegalese say they are ready to turn the page as they head to the polls on Sunday.
It was very simple. We don't need the trophy hunting day. Botswana does not need it. Countries in the SADC region that border Botswana, that is Zambia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia, and South Africa. When you talk of conservation of wildlife, we are a success story for the whole world to see.
Southern African countries oppose a United Kingdom legislation that seeks to ban the hunting of imported trophies.
He no longer has the opportunity to go and make a joke of himself doing things that are illegal. But also one has to realize that Museveni is a life president. I don't think that Museveni can allow his son to be president when he's alive.
And Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni appoints his son as the new chief of defense forces in a cabinet reshuffle. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Police say they are ready to turn the page and are excited to go to the polls Sunday to elect their next leader. This comes after weeks of debate and political crisis as outgoing President Macky Sall attempted to postpone the February 25th elections by 10 months, but was unsuccessful after the Constitutional Council overruled his decision. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo is in Dakar and has the story.
In the streets of Dakar, billboards of various candidates are scattered throughout the city as the population gets ready to go to the polls Sunday to elect the next leader of Senegal. Some have their favorites, but others say they just want someone who would unite and advance the West African nation. Let's listen to Sheikh Ahmed Tidiane Dia, Sokhna Mbaye, and Ibrahim Ndiaye.
Aliou Mamadou Dia est le maire des candidats.
I'll be voting for Aliou Mamadou Dia because, Sheikh Ahmed Tidiane Dia says, he's worked for UNDP, the United Nations Development Programme, and has 20 years of development-related experience. With that, I think he should be able to change the country.
Moi, je vais voter pour Bassirou Diomaye Diakhare Faye.
Sokhna Nata Mbaye says, I'll be voting for Bassirou Diomaye Diakhare Faye because he has the best profile for Senegal. He can take the country far, and he could improve our living conditions.
Du Sénégal, un changement radical des institutions.
And finally, Ibrahim Ndiaye, I'm voting for change, for development in Senegal, and a better way to govern. Senegal has always been seen as a beacon of democracy in a region plagued by coups until recently, when the country's outgoing president, Macky Sall, tried unsuccessfully to postpone the February elections by 10 months. While Sall had said he would not seek a third term, his critics accused him of wanting to hold on to power. Babacar Ndiaye is a political analyst.
C'est vrai que cette décision du président Macky Sall le 3 février était une décision étonnante.
He says it's true that when President Sall took that decision on February 3rd, it was surprising. We were a few hours before the electoral campaign was to officially kick off. That decision completely derailed the electoral process and caused the country to hold elections during the Ramadan fasting months and reduce the campaign time that candidates would have had to explain their various programs. About 19 candidates are vying for the top job, including former Prime Minister Amadou Ba, who's endorsed by Sall. Mamadou Bamba Ndiaye is with Ba's communication team.
Comme il le dit lui-même, il va aller plus vite, plus loin.
As he said himself, he hopes to go faster, further, and hopefully do better. President Macky Sall has said that nobody is perfect. While Sall thinks he had a positive assessment during his two terms, he's also said there's room for improvement. Other candidates include Bassirou Diomaye Faye, a former tax inspector. He's backed by Ousmane Sonko, who was seen as the key challenger to Sall, but has been barred from running in this year's elections over a previous defamation conviction. Both Faye and Sonko were recently released from prison. Moustapha Sarré is with Bassirou Diomaye Faye's coalition campaign team.
Nous avons connu au moins une semaine de retard par rapport aux autres candidats.
He says, compared to other candidates, we started our campaign a week late, but the Senegalese population was waiting for our candidate, Bassirou Diomaye Diakhar Faye, and you've seen the crowds his liberation from prison had attracted and the fever the campaign caravan stops by him and Sonko are creating. We think we can win this election in the first round. Djibril Ngeng is the executive director of PACT, a civil society group working for election transparency.
Je voulais simplement peut-être lancer un appel.
He says, we are calling on the Interior Minister to take all the useful tools to make sure the elections, which constitute a big phase for Senegal's present and future, that it's well monitored, that it takes place in a peaceful and calm environment, and that the polls are honest, transparent, and just. That way, he says, there won't be any challenges, and hopefully Senegal will be back on track to being the stable democratic country it's been over many decades. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
Still in Senegal, voters go to the polls on Sunday to choose a new president to replace outgoing President Macky Sall. Sall's second and final mandate expires on April 2nd, as enshrined in the Constitution. Prospective voters will choose among 19 presidential candidates, including a female business executive, to lead the Francophone West African country. It comes as the Electoral Commission prepares to administer the presidential vote on Sunday. For more on the presidential poll and expectations, Irish Mamadou Sek is a political analyst based in the Senegalese capital, Dakar.
The main expectations are the organization of these elections in a very fair way, given blurry situation previously and given the unprecedented situation as the president decided ahead 24 hours of the elections on 24th February to postpone this election. So currently people are ready to move forward and to hold the elections. So the main expectations are to have a free and fair election so that we can get a new president ready to hit the ground on April.
How enthusiastic are the people of Senegal to go to the polls on Sunday to choose a new president to take over from outgoing President Macky Sall?
Oh, you know, given all these previous events, people have been a little bit disappointed and discouraged. I think that the main challenge is to leverage the participation of the citizens. If you see the campaign, it has been really very calm. It can be linked to the Ramadan, the fasting period, both for Christians and for Muslims. But I think that we need to be more mobilized and to have an acceptable rate of participation, which is a very paramount criteria to assess an electoral process. I think that people are quite a little bit very calm. If we compare it to the last election campaign on 2019, but hopefully, I think that, you know, we have a big amount of people who are quiet and ready to make their choice and get back to home without troubles, without confrontations, without troubles.
How are people reacting to the campaign?
In the past, they were more responsive if we compare it to the last electoral campaign. As you may know, we are in the Ramadan period, so this can be a reason. The second reason is that, you know, we have 19 candidates. Sometimes this can be really very confusing for the citizens, so that they prefer to stay at home and wait polling days and go make their choice and get back home. The other thing is that, as you may know, there was so much controversies prior to go to open the electoral process. the main opponent, political opponent, has been sent to jail. And the incumbent president won't run for a new term. This means that sometimes it has been some disappointing from the citizens. But now that Sonko has been free, and the candidate of PASTEF, the main opponent political party, is free as well, this has created a kind of enthusiasm. And now that we have also the candidate from the ruling party, Amadou Ba, is now ready to go on the ground, because during the pre-electoral period he was a little bit shy. Now we can see him embracing people, discussing with them, etc. We can find a kind of new motion, and hopefully we'll get this same motion ahead the electoral process and the polling days on Sunday.
19 presidential candidates. Some people are projecting that they foresee a runoff. Do you see that happening?
Probably, but who knows? We can foresee this. But, you know, forcing is quite betting, and we are not very sure, depending on the behavior of the electors here in Senegal, depending on the what next from now to the end. You know, it's really very difficult to bet something, but I think that taking into account our political process, our political sense in terms of democracy, we could probably expect a second round.
Mamadou Seck is a political analyst. He spoke with me from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. Botswana's environment and tourism minister says countries in southern Africa are sharply opposed to a proposed United Kingdom measure that will ban the hunting of imported trophies. Dumezweni Mthimkhulu this week addressed the British Parliament over Botswana concerns about the legislation. He tells VOA in an exclusive interview that the proposed legislation will backfire, harm local communities, set back conservation efforts, increase poaching, and lead to the loss of wildlife habitats. Mthimkhulu led a Botswana delegation involving technocrats, traditional leaders, and victims of wildlife to the UK Parliament. They were also joined by top envoys and high government officials from Zambia, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Tanzania, Namibia, and South Africa to oppose the bill. Dumezweni Mthimkhulu tells me that if passed, the legislation will undermine conservation efforts and reduce revenue that helps rural communities in Botswana and sister countries in the region. Here's part one of the conversation.
It was very simple. We don't need the trophy hunting bill. We don't need it. Botswana does not need it. Countries in the SADC region that border Botswana, that is Zambia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia, and South Africa, we don't need it. When you talk of conservation of wildlife, we are a success story for the whole world to see. See, Botswana has the largest number of wild elephants in the world. We also have, I think, the third largest number of lions in the world. So if you look across all species that the bill want to make a subject of the ban, we have done very well in respect to all of them.
Minister Mthimkhulu, I understand that Botswana depends, one of its major GDP contributors is tourism. Will this anti-trophy bill at the British Parliament undercut such source of income or revenue for your government? Is that the reason why your government is against it?
No, not necessarily. What we are concerned about is our communities living in those areas. You know, every year, the government issues a quota of 400 elephants. And these elephants are given to community trust. It is them who derive income from this hunting band because they live amongst these animals. And not necessarily the government. The government does not. Of course, when somebody comes into Botswana, he will buy from a shop, he will rent, he will book an hotel, he will use local transport, at the end of the day, he pay taxes and stuff. But our main concern, it is the communities that live with these animals. Anyway, I say, see, our numbers of elephants are going up. Every year, I was telling one of the British journalists here that, you know what, sometimes maybe you should come to Botswana and take some of these animals to Britain so that you can understand the menace we're talking about, the problems we are facing when we have to look after these things. So that you...
What do you say to experts who say that culling leads to extinction?
Culling leads to extinction? In Botswana, the story on the ground is different. They need to confront the facts. We'll give them facts, hard facts. You cannot come to Botswana and say that culling has led to extinction when our numbers have increased from 50,000 to 130,000. They cannot dispute those numbers. They can't. They cannot dispute the number population of buffaloes that we have that have risen by over 10,000 in the wild. They cannot dispute the number of lions that we have. They cannot dispute the number of wild dogs. They cannot dispute those. Because they are increasing, they are exponential. They're just a huge increase of these animals out there in the forest. And they cannot dispute those. So we don't know what they are looking for if they cannot dispute those numbers.
So why do you think the bill is hypocritical? Because that's the stance of your government. Why do you think it is?
Yeah, it is. It is. We also heard when I arrived here from the British members of parliament that they also kill the deer for their antlers and they export them. And yesterday we had a group of scientists, there were four of them, who were explaining that the export of these trophies from Britain, they were giving figures. So they allow it, they want to ban it from our own country. So I'm not the Minister of Foreign Affairs. I'll put myself in trouble. But you see, they're still stuck in the old mentality where they believe that we are under their control. We're not a sovereign nation. But what if we, because the economic power and political power, they have it, and military power, they have it. So they want to now detect terms of how we deal with our situations in our own countries. And that is very sad. It's very sad.
Dumedzweni Mthimkhulu is Botswana's Environment and Tourism Minister. He spoke with me from London. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. The chief whip of the Opposition Democratic Alliance, or DA, in South Africa's parliament, is calling for the resignation or removal of Nosiviwe Mapisa Nkakula, the Speaker of Parliament, over corruption allegations. Siviwe Gwarube is also calling on other opposition parties in the legislature, including the governing ANC, to support a motion of no confidence in the Speaker. Her remarks come after authorities raided the Johannesburg home of Mapisa Nkakula over allegations of corruption while she was defense minister. Parliamentarian Siviwe Gwarube tells me that legal troubles undermine the credibility of the parliament.
It is important that the speaker must resign, or alternatively, if she is not prepared to resign, we have been opted to move a motion of no confidence in the South African parliament. We have written to the deputy speaker. The deputy speaker becomes the recipient in this instance of the motion against the speaker, because of course ordinarily you would write to the speaker, but we have submitted the motion of no confidence and have received confirmation of receipt. And here we are simply saying that the speaker has options. She must either resign or the motion of no confidence. And of course, if the ANC is not prepared to instruct her to step down, as they would ordinarily do to some of their members, then they should very well be welcome to support our motion. But if they don't and they protect her and shield her from accountability, they would have to explain to the people of South Africa why it is that they would condone such behavior, and they would condone having somebody who is the leader of the legislature in that position be suspected and accused and possibly arrested for such conduct.
Isn't the DA jumping the gun, especially when these are allegations and investigations ongoing? She has not been convicted. That will prevent her from effectively carrying out as a leader of the legislature. Isn't this jumping the gun?
Not at all. Our view is simply this. The head of the legislative arm of state, the person needs to, as per the, what the Constitution envisions and what the rules of Parliament say, that one, you've got to uphold the integrity of Parliament. That this person has to make sure that their conduct does not erode public trust in the institution. So what is clear here from the text and the intention of the rules is that the person who occupies this position needs to be beyond reproach. Secondly, our role is meant to be one of holding the executive to account. And yet our very own head of the institution is suspected of and accused of corruption. She certainly cannot continue in this current role.
Do you have the numbers to back you in this motion of no confidence to remove her?
We are reaching out to other opposition parties in order for them to sell motion of no confidence. However, of course, we know that the ANC has the numbers in this instance. And if they don't support the motion, then it will be incumbent on them to explain to the people of South Africa why that it is that the speaker did not resign or why it is that they did not support the motion. Then they have to explain to the people of South Africa why they think she's still suited for such a role when it is evident that the allegations she's facing and the possible arrest that is imminent is something that is quite serious. And so it doesn't prevent us. I mean, numbers will not prevent us from being able to do our job. And so that is why we're proceeding with the motion.
The speaker is arguing that the evidence is not there. And so these are mere allegations of corruption with no tangible evidence to convict it. And that is why people are saying perhaps this is just politics to make the ANC unpopular ahead of the coming elections.
Well, my take is that she should pursue that with the National Prosecuting Authority. Remember, our case for emotional confidence is very much targeted with her conduct and the allegations that she is facing are bringing the institution into disrepute. The veracity of the evidence that is there or not there, that is something that her legal team, which we hope that she is paying for and not the institution, that is something that that she needs to take up with the NPA. But we are mostly concerned about the integrity of the institution of Parliament. Parliament should not be embroiled in the business of defending a sitting speaker from allegations of corruption. Parliament should be more engaged with dealing with issues that are facing South Africans the most. And right now, her conduct, the allegations that she is facing, and her personal legal battles are now distracting from the work of Parliament. And this is why we believe that the person who heads up the institution should, regardless of where the status of the investigation is, it cannot be that your legal problems are now the core business of Parliament.
Siviwe Gwarube is the chief whip of the Opposition Democratic Alliance, or DA, in South Africa's parliament. She spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. In Zambia, the Congress of Trade Unions is hosting their annual meeting or New Year's School of the African Labour Unions in the capital, Lusaka. More than 100 delegates from across Africa are participating in the four-day conference organized by the African Regional Organization of Trade Union Confederation. The theme is Advancing Africa's Transformative Agenda, Mobilizing for Concrete Collective Union Action. As part of the conference, delegates held a solidarity meeting. It called for bold and transformative solution to resolve what they say is the ongoing debt crisis facing African countries, including Zambia. The annual gathering, organizers say, has become a platform for discussions and reflections on important social, economic, and political issues Africa faces. For more about the trade union's New Year's School in Zambia, I reach Blake Mulala. He is the president of the Zambia Congress of Trade Unions.
One of the major issues which we're looking at, most African countries are affected with the debt. And we, the labor movement, the trade union, we thought of taking part in trying to see what we can do on the debt situation in Africa. And we were taking example for Zambia. The Zambian government, they did reach a debt restructuring deal in 2022 with the official lenders, but they remain with the commercial ones. These are the private lenders who have delayed the process. So this delayment in reaching a conclusion of the debt restructuring process, it is like we are being choked with it because the workers are not getting the best from the bargaining table with the public service unions because government, they are pointing to the debt situation which they have and the resources which they have cannot meet the demands which we, the workers, are putting on the table.
The question is, who is to be blamed?
In the first place, we need to blame previous governments who led us to be in the situation where we are in because they borrowed money. They had an appetite for borrowing, and this money which was being borrowed was not put to good use. So we put entirely the blame to it, but we are not going to focus on that. We want to focus to see what can we do to come out of this situation where we are in. And hence, we as a labor leaders, trade unions, are saying to the lenders, can you give Africa space? Give Africa time to breathe? So Africa are suffocated. And can we have a chance for Africa to begin either cancel these debts, because these debts are legacy debts, and they are affecting major economies of Africa. Delivery service on education, healthcare, all the sector of the economy are affected. And we invited these ambassadors to these countries who are delaying the process to come and petition them to say, speak to your leaders in the countries where you are coming from. They must speed up the process and make sure that Africa is given a chance to be given space to breathe and attend to major areas of the economy where African leaders are hit mostly.
There's a school of thought that those people who contracted the money in Africa should be held accountable for their actions and not for their individual outside businesses to suffer as a result of their mismanagement. What's your response to that?
It will be very difficult. It will be very unfair for them not to have a human face to punish generations of people who are innocent. And one other thing, Peter, look, when these governments were going to borrow, they don't consult the trade unions. The labor movement are not put in the picture. They go and borrow. But we, the workers who are feeling the effect of this unnecessary borrowing, we are made to feel the heat because we have now to tighten our belts through paying high taxes. So, yes, we understand. We believe that they went to the black market because they never consulted. And that's I think it's a lesson to leaders of Africa that they must never go to borrow without engaging other stakeholders like the trade union movements. That's why now we have come on board.
The anti-corruption crusaders in Zambia and parts of Africa have said that those public officials who contracted this debt should be held accountable for their actions to serve as a deterrent. And they believe once that is handled effectively, future borrowing will be measured and that will serve also as a notice to those who lend the money to be more considerate. What are your thoughts?
I can't refuse to agree with you on that one. It's quite a good step, yes, but what do we do with the leaders who are no longer in offices and who are not responsible for what they did? Should we leave the situation continue and let the majority suffer for their mistakes? So we are starting afresh, and when you start afresh to correct the past mistakes, it means government must engage other stakeholders like the labor movement, because our workers, the people we represent mostly, are the ones who suffer for bad economic conditions which were made by previous administrations. And I hope the new crop of African leaders are going to take a leaf from what their predecessors did, and that they are going to start on a new note where they consult. There is nothing wrong to borrow, Peter. People live by borrowing. Major countries in the world, they borrow. But what's important, the money which is borrowed, is it put to good use or no? So that's where lies the question. So most African countries, they will borrow, but the money which they borrow may not be for the intended purpose. It's not helping to grow the economy because they were borrowing, but what did that money work for?
Blake Mulala is the president of the Zambia Congress of Trade Unions. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Uganda, President Yoweri Museveni has named his son Muhoozi Kainerugaba as the new chief of defense forces in a cabinet reshuffle. The move also saw two prominent supporters of the president's son as state ministers. Critics say the change is yet another example of the president preparing the grounds to eventually hand over power to his son. Until recently, Muhoozi Kainerugaba, who is serving in the military, has been campaigning across the country as leader of the Patriotic League of Uganda. For analysis of the latest cabinet reshuffle and political development, I reach attorney Tony Tumukunde. He is the founding partner at the law firm called MS Tumukunde & Co. Advocates.
The recent cabinet reshuffle by President Yoweri Museveni, to many, I think, in Uganda, it does not surprise them. That is how he holds his cards to his heart in playing politics in Uganda. He's a very hard president to determine. You cannot know his next step. But many have been expecting that he will at least bring his son closer, or any of the allies to his son closer, or royalists closer to his cabinet. And it also shook not only the cabinet, but it shook the army. For me, the cabinet, whereas many of the people have castigated the cabinet, I look at him giving chance to the young generation, but also the promotion and the washing away of the suspicion as to whether the son will become at one time a president of Uganda is now becoming visible. He cannot hide it anymore.
Well, this is what I was going to ask you, because in 2013, a former intelligence officer who held a high ranking talked about the Muhoozi project. This latest cabinet reshuffle, people are suggesting that this is a clear indication that President Museveni would want his son to succeed him.
His elevation to CDF comes at a time when General Muhoozi has intensified his political activities, which many have looked as ignoring army law and a constitution which forbids participation of serving soldiers in partisan politics. You may remember that a year ago, General Kainerugaba announced on March 15th, 2023, that he would run for presidency in 2026, even when in Uganda it is generally believed that his father's plans to offer himself for re-election in the same 2026 election is glaringly evident, because as his father is campaigning, the son is also campaigning. But it also elevates the son to having a command in the whole army. The question is as to whether the Bush War generals now, who have been castigating the son not being capable of being a president of Uganda, will now salute him. It causes a rift in the army. And we are yet to see whether the son will be ready to cascade over the suspicions that many have had.
What happens to his Patriotic League of Uganda, which many are suggesting that is a civic organization, some are suggesting it's a platform for him to launch his presidential ambitions?
You understand that PLU, the Patriotic League of Uganda, is not registered as a political party yet. It's registered as a civic organization, and it is illegal outrightly for a civic organization to involve itself in political organizations and political affairs. General Muhoozi has argued that he is not actually fronting his political ambitions, but is holding birthday celebrations, is holding supporter celebrations, probably to solve problems that the national resistance movement has failed to solve. Problems to do with corruption, problems to do with road infrastructure, problems to do with tribalism.
But doesn't that mean that the president himself has failed, because he is the leader of the NRM and he is the president? So if he has set up a civic organization to address or resolve issues that you are raising, then it ostensibly put it on the lap of the president, don't you think?
I don't think so. I think the president has let him to be. The president it was very hard for General Muhoozi to be sold to the public, and the chances that the father has given him, considering from way back March 8th, 2022, when Muhoozi was just elevated to the third rank hierarchy in the UPDF, to being sent to Rwanda, being sent to Kenya, being sent to Somalia, Egypt. These are all preparations that the president has given him. And there is no serving soldier in Uganda that can be allowed to civically celebrate their birthday.
Some Ugandans are saying Uganda is a democracy and not a monarchy. And the latest government reshuffle shows that it's more of a monarchy from their perspective, the government perspective, or from the president perspective, than what a lot of Ugandans are aspiring to. Your take?
You see, President Museveni is very sharp. In Uganda, it is now common that if your mother, your father, who has been a politician, maybe a member of parliament, dies, most of the electorates will front their sons and daughters to the deceased. So it's now used. He first sold those ideas to people. The ruling party, the opposition parties, have now fronted the sons and daughters to the deceased to take up positions. So it's becoming a common thing. So it's no longer news. But for me, I would tell you that, be that as it may, Muhoozi, who wears many hats, including the role now of Senior Presidential Advisor of Special Operations, has been traversing the country alongside his supporters under the cover of PLU, who are keen to have him succeed his father.
Attorney Tony Tumukunde is the founding partner of the law firm called MS Tumukunde & Co. Advocate. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In addition to the insecurity and food crisis faced by people displaced by war in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, they are also threatened by carbon dioxide from volcanic tissue matter, commonly known as mazuku, in camps west of the city of Goma. More than 10 displaced people have already died from asphyxiation by these substances, reports the Goma Volcano Observatory. For VOA Zanem, Neti Zaidi reports from Goma.
The Goma Volcano Observatory, OVJ, says it has already reported 11 deaths of internally displaced people linked to asphyxiation by carbon dioxide, commonly known as mazuku, in sites located in the western Goma. Mathieu Yalire is a researcher in the geochemistry department at OVG. He says in the only Bulengo camp, there are 20 gas storage sites. Initially, the displaced people settled in high-risk areas, and then they started to die. He says they've already counted around 11 people who have lost their lives. The latest death linked to the presence of gas happened less than a week ago, according to the chief of the Lakver area, Dedesi Mitima, who is already involved in sensitizing internally displaced people and is calling for central government intervention. He says there is always a need for the authorities to take action, especially at a time when they have so many displaced people fleeing the war against the M23 rebels. He says they have also tried to put up banners around areas that are dangerous. For its part, the Provincial Division of Social Affairs, whose head of office in North Kivu is Nicole Kapinga, believes that it is vital to relocate all of the sites for the displaced in order to save lives, particularly children and people living with disabilities. She says they are lobbying the authorities to identify safe sites to bring the displaced. She says the problem of Mazuku affects disabled people in particular, as they are not able to flee from danger. The Bulengo, Lushagala and Mugunga camps are the most exposed to the presence of Mazuku or carbon dioxide from volcanic matter. However, according to the latest communique from the OVG, the activity of the Nyiragongo and Nyamulagira volcanoes remains normal and the alert level is at yellow for vigilance. For VOA Africa, I'm Zanem Netizaidi in Goma.
Malawi's parliament is considering legislation to permit the cultivation of marijuana or cannabis. The aim is to boost the country's foreign exchange earnings, but anti-drug advocates are against it. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre.
Lawmaker Peter Dimba told the parliament Thursday that locally grown cannabis is in high demand abroad and could yield millions of dollars for the country.
In fact, from the studies that were done, it is envisaged that when we start growing our local chamber, we'll be able to generate as much as $200 million per year at the infancy stage of the industry. But as the industry grows to maturity, we'll be able to earn as much as $700 million. In fact, it's more than double what we are actually currently getting from the sale of tobacco.
Chamba is the local name for cannabis. Malawi has long relied on tobacco, which accounts for about 13% of its gross domestic product and 60% of its foreign exchange earnings. But over the years, tobacco prices have fallen, largely because of anti-smoking campaigns championed by the World Health Organization and the proven link between tobacco use and cancer. In 2020, Malawi enacted a law permitting the cultivation of hemp, the non-psychoactive part of the cannabis plant, as an alternative to tobacco farming. But farmers say industrial hemp hasn't yielded the expected results. Matthews Osman leads a cooperative of industrial hemp farmers in Nchinji District in central Malawi. He says there is a stronger market for cannabis with the plant's mind-altering ailment, THC.
The industrial hemp took a long time for us to find a enforceable buyer. With this high THC, there seems to be a lot of buyers on the ground.
Osman also says another problem with industrial hemp was that the seeds were imported and expensive, while with a local cannabis variety, the seeds are expected to be cheaper. Patrick Garawanda is the spokesperson for the religious group Rastafarians in Malawi, which uses marijuana for spiritual purposes. He says he hopes the legalization of cannabis will prevent them from getting arrested whenever they are found with cannabis.
It's been a long time I've been crying over this thing. Because actually the Rastafari family will use that for the spiritual purpose and for medicinal purposes. So they must stop arresting Rastafari family for the sake of cannabis.
Some Malawians want cannabis cultivation to remain illegal. Nelson Zakeyu is executive director for Drug Fight Malawi, a local NGO which has long fought against drug abuse.
This is worrisome because cannabis is a drug. Cannabis is addictive. Cannabis is poisonous. It is very, very problematic, especially to teenagers. because the scientists have said that once young people under the age of 21 start using cannabis, their brain is permanently damaged.
Zakeyu says another worry is that according to research his organization conducted last year, the number of teenagers using cannabis doubled soon after Malawi legalized the use of industrial hemp in 2020. He says the number would sour further if cannabis with the high content of THC could be legally grown. Richard Chingwendo Banda is the leader of government lawmakers in parliament. He says the government will handle the matter with caution.
As government, we are very cautious because we have the duty and obligation to protect our people, our young people. And that will make sure that if you make ratios that anything else that comes in protects our young people, protects the nation. But when it comes to the economic benefits of it, we must make sure we facilitate the economic benefit of it.
Lawmakers are still working on the bill to amend existing laws on cannabis. It is not clear when the measure might come up for a vote. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Sanira, kakutwali mugebe hiyo. Kajibwa jampungi lako.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga and engineer Leon Wang, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the hand that makes mistakes belongs to those who work. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.